So I'm going to talk tonight about emptiness, trying to figure out emptiness, because it's a big concept. Everybody knows about it, and there's a lot of confusion about it, and my goal for tonight is to clear up all that confusion. Because it's an important concept. The Buddha said that he spent much of his time abiding in emptiness. And the Dalai Lama says that without understanding emptiness, we leave ourselves vulnerable to clinging. So the idea is to come up with some kind of conceptual understanding, and then we can look forward and practice. Because we're talking about internal experiences. I'm reading Ram Dass's current book, Walking Ourselves Home, and he was talking with a close friend, and they're talking about end of life, and she asks him why he tells so many stories. And he says, well, the concepts are hard to... And he sort of trails off. So this is stuff may seem a little heady, but in the end, to be able to see the emptiness of the self enables compassion rather than aversion. So that's where we're going to try to end, where we're going to head. Let me just first say that emptiness is the biggest confusion about emptiness is the notion that it refers to the emptiness of all things. You know, the cosmos is empty, all things arise from the emptiness of some primordial something and then goes back to it. You know that one, everything arises and goes back to emptiness. That's not the Buddha's teaching. No, the oneness of all things, the Buddha never talked about that. That's all somebody else is teaching. That's mostly Brahmin and Hindu dharma teachings. So the Buddha never talked about those, and this is not what the Buddha really is getting at. Although there's a lot of baggage around that, and there's a tendency to hear that in the word. But the Buddha was talking about something that is a feature of our language and the way we use language and relate to our experience in the world. So let me share my understanding of how this works, and if it's incoherent, please let me know by saying, what are you talking about? So here we are in the middle of this constantly changing, rushing stream of experience. Nothing stays put. Everything is changing. Everything is changing. Heraclitus said you can't step in the same river twice because it's not really the same river. Conceptually, it's river, but the experience... Robert Rauschenberg, an American painter, said you can't look at my paintings twice, not because the molecules are changing, but because you're different. You're different. What you were thinking when you walked in the door, gone, you know? It's just a constant rushing change. We are designed. Any of you read Robert Wright's book, Why Buddhism is True? He says, by our creator, natural selection, to be survival machines, to survive and reproduce, built into the organism. And we've got this incredible brain that is the most complex thing that we've found in the universe. And it is an incredible survival tool that's enabled us to overrun the planet. And we're really good. And the way it works, this is my understanding of the way it works, and see if this description works for you. This is just, things are just rushing, changing all the time. And we take, our brain creates nouns and verbs. It creates nouns and verbs as naturally as a spider will make the web a circle. You know, I don't think that the spiders got together and said circles are good. If they did, the black widows weren't there. You know, but that's just expressing them. We create nouns and verbs, and the nouns are sort of snapshots of our experience that enable us to hold that experience in mind so that all this neurology up here can make associations and predict better, make ourselves more so we create these snapshots. If I just use the phrase 9/11, let's just see what happens in your mind. 9/11. Think of 9. You might think of where you were when you first heard, or you might know somebody, or maybe you'd been there, or just all what kind of associations in the wake of and the war. And just that concept enables us. If you think of your mother, you may have an image, a particular memory, some feelings about all. Just the concept enables the brain to organize. So we think nouns and verbs. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that there are no nouns in our experience. So, you know, we think of this as a piece of paper, right? Thich Nhat Hanh has a really beautiful passage where he says, when you see a piece of paper like this, can you see the rain cloud over the forest that produced the wood that was harvested, etc., and the workers and the designers who made the factories, and the, you know, in this piece of paper are all the conditions which give rise to it. And it's impermanent. These molecules weren't in this configuration not so long ago, and it won't be so long before they're not in this configuration more, but we still think of it as a thing. A cloud is a thing. You know? Well, cloud is a noun, isn't it? It's a thing. It may, you know, it's dependent on conditions. You know? How much water there is in the air, what the temperature is, how the winds are, all kinds of stuff. Some things, and impermanent. That doesn't mean that calling it a cloud isn't useful. But our world is full of things in motion, because our brain creates a world that we live in that's full of things. And we forget that none of this exists for very long. Everything's changing. Nouns occur in language, but not in our experience. In fact, you know, they're sort of like mirages. You know. Or there's a neuroscientist down at UC Irvine, Donald Hoffman, and he says our consciousness, he uses a metaphor of a computer screen. So you've got a folder on your computer screen, right? It's not really a folder. It just stands for something back in there. But if you drag it to the trash, and you know it's not really the trash. But if you drag it to the trash, something happens. So even though we may see nouns and things aren't really nouns, that doesn't mean that our experience is not of something. And if you stub your toe on a rock, call it what you want, you know, ow. So the idea is that these concepts are in our mind. They're, you know, Plato made these concepts the ultimate realities. These concepts are in our mind, and we reify them. The word reify is just, it's a great word. If you try to figure out what it means, just Google it and try. It's really fun because it everybody says to reify is to reify. But it actually is a word that refers to the process by which we attribute reality to the concept. In computer science, it has a technical term. So you have a model of an app that you're building, and you reify it, which is to write the code and make it actually happen, make it real. So the idea is we make real some of these concepts that are really abstractions. And we abstract out of our experience. So for example, if I move my hand, you say, my hand is moving. But we'll abstract from that motion and hand, even though there's only just this one gesture. And it's not wrong. In fact, by understanding motion in, you know, the abstract notion of motion, the notion of motion, the abstract notion of motion in more detail, we can aim a rocket at Mars. You know, I still find that amazing. I even find it amazing that we can put something in orbit, but because I don't understand the math. But they seem to be, seems to work. So we have these abstract notions, but the reality of our experience is all combined. But we can abstract from it. We can think of motion as separate, but you need two things. Motion is dependent on at least two things. If there were only one thing and nothing else anywhere, what would motion mean? So you need two things. It's dependent on two objects. Time is a concept. We think of it as really something there. But time is not separate from space. You have to have something change. Time is dependent. Cause and effect. See, the idea of cause and effect is really perfect. It's just what we want to do, is to figure out what's going to happen next so that we can get a leg up. Our agenda, survive, right? Survive and reproduce. And the brain figures out incremental steps for helping us live forever or die trying. We abstract consciousness. All this experience is experience of something. I'm conscious of the pen, I'm conscious of the bell. So we think, well, there's consciousness, it's a noun. We think it's a thing, just because it's a noun. And all of these things are dependently arisen. Sunset, isn't that, you know, sunset, you think of sunset as a thing, but your sunset is somebody else's sunrise, somebody else's midday. It depends on your position in relation to the earth and the sun. It's a constructed thing. All these abstract terms that we assume are real. How about the Department of Motor Vehicles? No, you can say that's an office of, but the Department of Motor Vehicles itself, it's an abstract, the government, grumble, grumble. There's no government. You know, I mean, I'm not, you know. So everything is changing constantly. We have these abstract notions, one of which is ourself, who we are. We have these abstract notions that we believe and reify. We turn them into reality. When actually they're more like mirages. You know, you go to the desert and you look out there and you see a blue lake. And you're brand new to the scene and you say, oh, water. But, you know, if you've been out in the desert before and you know, you look and you say, I see what you see, but I don't think it's water. And you've got a different frame for it. Frame is, well, you know, it has to do with refraction indexes and the reflection off the sky and yada, yada. So both of you see the same thing. But you see it differently. You don't. Okay, so We're sort of looking at dependently arisen phenomena. Everything is dependent on everything else. Everything is embedded in everything else. You can't separate a cause from an effect. If there were a cause with no effect, well, it sort of wouldn't be a cause. Right? You know. So in our experience, there's just flow. In our mind, we're trying to figure things out to help us not fall. You know what I mean? The notion of this idea is articulated more in the notion of the two truths, which actually wasn't, this was really spelled out most completely by a guy named Nagarjuna, who lived right about the turn of the millennium, the zero, what do we call that? The zero point.
The birth of Christ.
I'm sorry?
The birth of Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah. But that was earlier. That wasn't zero. Whatever zero is, when it turns over. That's so he lived about then.
The common era.
The common era, yeah. Well, right, okay, at the beginning of the common era. So, and he articulated this notion of two truths. The conventional truth and ultimate truth. Now, I've heard some confusion about that, and people talk about conventional reality and ultimate reality. But he wasn't talking about that. He was talking about the language that describes our experience and that points at our experience. So the conventional truth is the world that we know. You know, when we think that water boils at zero or water freezes at zero or water freezes at 32 degrees, that's conventional. Language is conventional. Driving on the left side of the road is conventional. Or the right side of the road. No. Our understanding of things is conventional. The idea of ultimate is the idea of something that is beyond, that is not conventional. Something that is inherently real itself. Something that may be, that transcends. But these are just concepts. The notion of ultimate truth is just an idea. It's just a conventional truth. The idea of emptiness is that conventional truth is empty. It's not that there's nothing there. You look at the mirage and there it is. It's just not what you think it is. And because of that, because we think that there is a thing there, there becomes something to grasp, something to try to attain, trying to get. And we represent it to ourselves with these concepts. So I'm standing in at Pete's, and I'm third person in line, and the person in front of me is staring into the pastry cabinet. And I'm thinking, wonder what it's like. I go stare into the pastry cabinet. When it's my turn, I stared, and there was this piece of yellow cake with a lot of frosting on the top. Have you already tasted it? Right, me too. But then I looked at the bear claw, and it had those almond things, and you taste that too? So that's how there's that just that little flash, and in that flash, we decide how pleasant that's going to be. And then we throw the on switch, you know, go. And we go. And we do it for all of our stuff. I mean, we navigate by pleasant. Kama tanha. We navigate by pleasant. That's our disposition. We don't look for unpleasant stuff. We don't say, that restaurant was lousy, the service was bad, let's go tonight. We just don't. I mean, it sounds silly, but we navigate by pleasant and avoid unpleasant. Now, those experiences, that's not reified. You know that directly, the same way you know whether the breath is coming in or going out. Is this pleasant or unpleasant? It's the second foundation of mindfulness. So the ultimate truth about this conventional world is the conventional world is empty of thingness. There's a Zen koan that just goes, unthing. Maybe you had to be there. I don't know. But we reify this dependently arisen in each of our minds. Each of our minds we live in different worlds. You know? When we were sitting here, I bet you nobody was thinking of my dog. Yeah. Each of us has our experience that comes to the present moment, and our behavior appears on its own. We are dependently arisen. We think of ourselves as agents. We think of ourselves as actors. And we say things like, don't identify with this, as if we actually identify with anything. Identification just happens. You sit to follow your breath. What happens? Yes. Thoughts come, right? It's not just me. Thoughts come. And the thoughts come and you can't stop them. Have you tried to stop them? It's really fun to try. Well, maybe not. But you can't stop them. They're coming, and the neuroscience people will tell you that it's because the neurological stuff is starting about 200 milliseconds before we become aware of it. So that means if you're not doing that thinking is happening on its own. But then identification happens, and we say the words, I'm thinking about it. The thoughts are happening. You know, we create an I. It's like an it's raining. What's this it? I'm thinking, what's this I? If you go looking for it, you know, I want to lose weight, I want to eat that piece of cake. Which is the true self? Well, they're just different neurological circuits. You know? And if there's no cake present, the question doesn't come up. So it's a conditioned arising. There is only this current flowing, this unfolding. And we create this world in our mind as a practical tool for helping us survive. We really don't know we think we know. What's the Rabindranath Tagore? How do you pronounce his name? Anybody know? Rabindranath. That's it. What she said. He said, we think clearly, but that's just because we're not thinking clearly. No. Does anybody know what's going on? I mean, really? Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm just asking, you know? I mean, what is this? Did anybody... My daughter posted on her Facebook page the three stages of life. Birth, what the fuck is this? And death. Do we know? Anybody have an idea? Really? No. But we think we know stuff, don't we? We've got stories about what's going on in the world, you know, and who we are, and what things are, and how things work. And generally, so far, we've been able to find our way home. You know, we have this practical knowledge. It's practical. It isn't necessarily accurate. In fact, it's not accurate. It can't be. All these colors, don't we think these colors are in the room? But they're all in your neurology. They're all happening. The Buddha said, in this fathom-long body is the whole universe. And we think sugar is sweet. Sugar is not sweet. Sweet is what happens when it lands on your tongue and it's the experience. You know, it's not anything. Certainly not white. I've just discovered recently that a small percentage of women, it's maybe like 2 or 3%, have an extra cone in their eye. Anybody heard about this? So instead of the three cones, which got the three colors, primary colors that make up all these colors, they've got a fourth cone. And the color palette that they use to interpret the different. And do we have any idea? We can't have any idea. We think the world out there is the way we imagine it. So emptiness is just recognizing that the way things are is impermanent and without substance. And here's the problem. When we go to grasp at something, we think we're grabbing something. It's like we're going to take a pill to fix the headache. And, you know, you take the pill and maybe the headache goes away, but it does other things too. And we think of them as side effects. But that's just because we're paying attention to the headache and we've got an intention to take it. It's not side effects, it's the effects. So, you know, all these things exist in context. So if you're reaching for a thing and it's not really a thing, it's just an image of a piece of lemon cake and how pleasant that will be, or what a good career would be. It would be nice to do that. Or you know, a partner or a job, you know, the house you imagine, and then we follow after what's pleasant. It's just sort of how we're wired. And part of that flashing moment of what we're going to attempt, what we're going to try, our intention, what our intention is, if that flashing moment is delusional, well then, we're likely to be surprised. And that surprise turns out sort of to be not getting what you want, which is one of the elements the Buddha described as dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of the world, the unsatisfactoriness of our experience. It's an interesting little shift here. Talk about the three characteristics of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, right? Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and emptiness. Okay. Are those qualities of existence, or are they qualities of our experience? We're talking about the same phenomena, but we're taking a phenomenological point of view in one. We're saying this is a subjective experience. Our subjective experience is impermanent. Anybody not notice that? You know, it's unsatisfactory. It can't be satisfactory. Because if you actually got what you want, it's going to change. And if it doesn't change, you're going to change. But it's not going to last. And that's not satisfactory. Because we want permanence. Don't we? I mean, that's what we want. Stability, safety, security. We want some novelty too. But, you know, we like it like, you know, riding a roller coaster. Oh, that was fun. You know, just not a lot of risk. You know, we like that stability. And of course, that's delusional. There's nothing that's stable. Buddha said, I searched for a place of refuge, and there was none. No place. That doesn't mean that there aren't ideas about security, stability, safety, permanence. Satisfaction. There are ideas about satisfaction. Oh, if only whatever your object of desire or aversion is. But, you know, we're not built for that. Because if we get what we want, was it Don Draper in the Mad Men? You know, he's an advertising exec in the 50s, and he said, happiness? Well, that's just the moment after you get what you want and before you want the next thing. Pretty interesting. I work at Folsom Prison some, and I walked in to see this guy last week. It was just the two of us, and he said, "How do you make yourself happy?" I said, "The pursuit of happiness is a fraud, because if you're pursuing it, you're not happy." It's a curse. It's a ruse. Because if you're dissatisfied, if you were satisfied, you wouldn't be pursuing happiness. But if you're satisfied, then you're satisfied with the way things are, and that's not satisfactory. You know what I mean? Is that coherent, or am I raving here? So the self is a dependently arisen phenomenon. It's empty of thingness. The neuroscience people will tell you that your intentions form about a fifth to a half of a second before you know they are happening. This is, they wire these guys up with the helmets and they say, punch the button whenever you want. And they watch and they can see. I don't know how they do that either. But they all seem to agree they're doing it. And I guess somebody's checking their math. Anyway, they can see when the intention begins to punch the button, and they can watch when it registers on that computer screen of our awareness. And so our intentions arise automatically too. You know, we think of ourselves as agents, but things are just unfolding. Somebody cuts in on you, your foot hits the brake before you've had a chance to even think brake. You know? I mean, it's on automatic pilot. We're in a position to surf in this stream entry. Somebody was talking about stream entry. Yeah. We can surf in this stream, not cling. But we're designed to cling and to reify this dependently arisen self. Who we think we are. Who do you think you are? That's the New Yorker cartoon of the drunk coming into the bar and says, "Who do you know who I think I am?" You have any idea who I think I am? So we have ideas about ourself. We have a vision of ourself. Some of these, this reification it's not just verbal concepts. So we think of ourself, we sort of have an onion view of ourself, of what the self is like. You know, it's an onion. It's got all these layers, and the deeper layers are more, you know, and they may look nice on the outside, but inside, deep down, I've seen him with his dog. He's not nice. He's really... So you can have the core essence and then the more superficial layers. Isn't that an image of how we think of people sometimes? But you could also have a different frame. You could be like a ticker tape. Oh, my God. Ticker tape? Okay. Okay. If you don't know, come and see me afterwards. So, you know, the ticker tape, the print head's just hit and the paper's just flowing. It's just flowing. And then there is this experience that you can look back and select a story. And then reify the story. But if there's no story, if there's just unfolding experience, then the dissatisfaction, and there's recognition that, you know, dissatisfaction comes with a territory, then what you see is not objects to get, to save you, to help you, to make you complete. You're just, you know, what's happening is you're not grasping things, you're going through motions. When you think you are grasping, getting something, you're going through motions. So we want to watch the motions. Just monitor the behavior that we're, you know, what we're in the midst of. And not be deluded by the object. Okay, so the moth sees the flame, right? The flame is bright and warm. The moth is designed, I don't know quite why, to fly at the flame, likes bright and warm. It doesn't see anything but the bright flame, doesn't see past it to the sides, and it certainly doesn't see its own compulsion to fly into the flame. And in it goes, and it's toast. We're the same way with objects of desire. We see it and we fly directly at it. We go for it. We have that lemon cake, you know, or the career as a whatever. Or, you know, I'll take the Lexus. Whatever. You know, whatever, you know, there's some moment, flash, image. But we have what the moth doesn't have. We have the capability of observing our own internal life. That's what this meditative practice gives us a chance to do, to observe our own compulsion. How are we built? How do we behave? And so the Buddha was really concerned that if we act out of delusion, we're going to suffer. We'll make things worse. I actually think that's the core of his teaching. Don't make things worse. There's, you know, the first in the prison context, I teach the first noble truth as shit happens. First noble truth, the truth of suffering: birth, aging, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, distress, lamentation, despair, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, losing what you care about. Bummers. All of them. And then what happens? We usually make things worse. Second truth. We usually make things worse. You're sitting there and you've decided you're going to meditate for 20 minutes and you're not going to move, and you get an itch. So, you know, how big is that itch? It's not lethal. But how big is the craziness that goes on in your brain about scratching it or not scratching it? Which is more? The itch? You know, the third truth is, of course, we don't need to suffer. We can not take the bait and not believe the delusion that satisfaction is possible, or that if we are grabbing something, we're making an effort to take something, do something, that it's separate from all other things, that there's always side effects to what we do. So what we can only watch our intention. But that's not something you can feel that. You can feel your wanting. You can feel your anger. You can feel your not wanting. In the same way you can feel your breath coming in and out. You can feel your stub toe, and you know the image of your mother and what 9/11 means to you. Those things are all directly perceived experience. the map that we build of our world to help us succeed with our agenda. You know, it's folders and trash baskets. And that's all that emptiness means. It doesn't mean that that folder shouldn't be dragged to the trash if you want to keep those files. And it's not that there's no self, you know, no self. It's a mirage. It's not that there's nothing there. It's just not what we think. All this stuff is happening on its own. We don't identify with anything. Identification happens. Desire happens because we're designed, we're want machines. One thing after another. You get what you want the next thing. So, you know, satisfaction is not in the cards for us. All these things arise because we're designed to seek pleasant experience and to make the unpleasant go away. Pain, unpleasantness, not good for the organism, not survival helpful. And when we abandon, when we just don't take the bait, when that urge to want arises, if we're not taking the bait, then we have a chance to respond to the pain and unpleasantness in ourselves and others with compassion rather than with aversion. It's not, get it off me. It's, oh my gosh, it's tough, it's on me again. I thought I'd taken care of that one. Oh, well. We don't want to be hurt. We want to keep ourselves from being hurt. We'll do anything, construct whole systems to avoid that. And then we act out our view of the world, our narrative of what's going on, whatever it is. Each of us has a slightly different one. So all abiding in emptiness is just, you know, recognizing that all things are impermanent. Our experience is where we're living. And that the abstraction that we do in our mind to help us survive and be successful is useful and practical, but it's not really accurate, and we're going to be surprised. Now let me just pause here and see if you're still with me. Emptiness is not a mystical concept. It's not otherworldly. For me, it's just really practical. It's immediate. I know how to use a pen. In Zen, they say, call this a pen, I'll hit you with it. Say it's not a pen, I'll hit you with it. What is it? Really, that's koan practice, right? That's what they do. I know what it is. It's the reason I practice in the Theravadan tradition. But they're getting at the same thing. They're getting at the same thing. If you get a conceptual understanding of this, then you can start practicing with it, looking for the dependencies. Yeah?
I've noticed, and I've been paying really strict attention to it, for example, anticipating after a really, really busy week and anticipating the weekend and what you're going to do. Yeah. And that thought is just so juicy and so wonderful, and you enjoy it so much, and then that weekend is never the great thing that you thought it was going to be. It's the thought of it that is so much better.
Well, yeah, and there's a reason for that, because that is what inspires. The neuroscience people will say that the doses of dopamine and whatever the other stuff is, but I can't remember. I forgot to go to medical school. I didn't take graduate courses, and when I did, they didn't know. So it's not my fault. Whatever it is, was not my fault. But we're designed to juice up anticipation. In fact, one of the guys in my group, some of you may know Rick Maddock, who's a neuropsychiatrist, he says that in studying addicts, the first hit is very pleasurable, but it's not very long before what's most pleasurable is setting up, is getting the spoon ready and the flame, and that all the paraphernalia becomes even more pleasurable. It's the anticipation. And this is what goes on in your mind. So one of my friends was at work on Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock. She's sitting in her cubicle, and her boss comes up and says, "First thing Monday morning, we got to talk. Goodbye, everybody." So that'll, you know, and what's that? That's just in your mind. The weekend was going to be, you know, but... So we live in this world. Bob Dylan used the phrase, thought dreams. We live in our thought dreams. And just to recognize that they are dreams, we can't live without them. We need them to be able to get home tonight. So they're not useless, but they set us up for suffering. They set us up for dissatisfaction. And there's already enough for making things worse. Because our expectations may be delusional. And if they are, well, then we're going to be surprised. So how's emptiness sitting with you guys? Yeah?
Can you give a practical application?
Of practicing with emptiness? Yeah, when you start thinking about something you want, you know, you think about it in more detail, the way I was suggesting about 9/11. What is that phenomenon that you are, because the idea is to demystify the attractiveness of the weekend or the yellow cake, because we get expectations and we juice them for biological reasons. So the idea is, I mean, the Buddha wants us to not chase after mirages. So we can I want recognition. Anybody ever, you want a little bit, somebody to recognize, to notice, you know? And we can spend a lot of time working on that. But it's really a nebulous kind of thing. You know, there's also just recognizing our own impulses to want. What does wanting feel like? We don't even feel it because we're so focused on the flame, like the moth is, the object of desire. We're so busy hating the politician of our choice, you know, that we don't even see our own aversion. We don't notice it. So part of the idea is to bring your experience directly to the present moment. Mind and body. Descartes said they're separate things and nobody can figure out how they work together because nobody knows what they are. Right? But in the meantime, mind and body are doing just fine. So the idea is to use this understanding to recognize the kinds of things we're grasping at and to see in our own self. We think, we judge ourselves. We think we're a thing that is good or bad or has this quality or that quality. So you can attenuate a lot of the pain that you inflict on yourself by just recognizing these thoughts as just, you know, part of the stream. And that there is, if you're this ticker tape, there isn't any one of those things that's you. That you don't exist any more substantially than a candle flame, dependent on conditions. We're dependent on oxygen, just like the candle flame, and fuel, just like the candle flame. And we are a light. You know, take the oxygen out of the room, we're all gone. We're not independent of anything. So we look for our dependencies, look more deeply. The Buddha's idea was that nibbana would be an experience that's not conditioned by greed and hatred and delusion. What kind of experience would that be? Yeah?
Would you say that practicing present moment awareness?
Absolutely.
Is one of the...
That's
something that I can...
Well, in present moment awareness, what do you notice? Everything's changing in there. Yeah, it's impermanent. Your experience is impermanent. You can say existence is impermanent or your experience is impermanent. They're the same thing, just from a slightly different conceptual frame. Impermanent, are they satisfactory? You know? But we've got ideas of satisfaction. If only, then I'd be, you know? You think of the yellow cake or you think of the weekend or you think of... Oh my God, I can't believe I thought it. Impeachment proceedings? I'm sorry. I really am. It's time. It's time to go. Yeah.
It's the wrong night for all this Zen stuff, but there's a Zen story I like. Two students were sitting with their Zen master watching a flag flapping in the wind. The first one student said, "The wind is flapping the flag." The second one said, "No, the flag is flapping the wind." The Zen master said, "You're both wrong. There is no flag."
Ah, so I heard the story a little different. I heard he said, "Your minds are flapping." but so that there is no flag is really, that's really interesting. I'm so glad you mentioned that. So you're out in the desert, and you see the mirage, but some guy puts on polarized glasses, and he looks out there and he doesn't see anything. So there's no mirage out there. This would be the standpoint of someone who takes the position of there is such a thing as ultimate truth. There is no, don't see a person, don't see a, you know, there isn't any, but really, that's just another conceptual frame. And it's a conceptual frame, it's a conventional frame. The mirage is the problem. The world that we live in is the problem. You know, because we don't see it with clear eyes. We see the mirage and mistake it for the mirage. We can say there's nothing there, and that would be the notion of ultimate truth. That would be the notion of something ultimate. Yes, there are no things. But there's also no ultimate truth. Because anything you could frame as an ultimate truth would be conventional. So it's interesting. They're different versions of the story, but both are illustrative. Yeah.
So Tony, what are you saying yes to then in life? Are you saying yes to knowing your lens, what glass you're looking through, that you see the mirage, you don't see the mirage?
You're saying yes to whatever arises. Krishnamurti was once asked to account for the quality of his demeanor, which was apparently particularly, I don't know, ethereal somehow. He said, my secret is I don't mind what happens. Equanimity. That doesn't mean, you know, equanimity. You say yes to what happens, whatever happens. And if what's happening is people suffering, what happens? Compassion arises. You know, if you're dissatisfied, no equanimity. If you need to be more of this or less of that or changed of this and needs to be different, I got to pursue my goals, pursuing happiness. You know. Well, that's just chasing a mirage. Pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You know how far away that pot of gold really is. So yeah, you say yes to everything. So you know the Dalai, that cartoon with the Dalai Lama opens his box, his present, and it's empty, and he says, "Just what I wanted." Please.
So, whenever I hear these talks about emptiness, and I agree, you know, I appreciate what's being said and everything, but I always come back at the end of the night and think about, well, geez, tomorrow I got to be back in the conventional world. You know, I got things to do. I mean, I feel like I'm flipping back and forth.
There is no ultimate world. This conventional world is the ultimate world. Notions of ultimacy are notions. They're ideas. So you're in the conventional world here. We have to live in it. We have to understand it in a way that enables us to live in it without making things worse for ourselves and others. And if we think that our happiness, our satisfaction depends on this or that, well then we're like the moth and the flame, whatever the this and the that is. Yeah.
So a guy named Asa Hayakawa about 30 years ago wrote a book called Language and Thought in Action, which is about this nouns and verbs. And,
yeah.
And just lost what. Anyway, he talked about the difference between the map and the territory.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to get from here to someplace I've never been before, I need to have the map.
Sure.
But as I'm going along, I shouldn't confuse the map with the real things around me.
Right.
So all these concepts are essential for navigating reality, as long as you remember that they're not really reality.
If you mistake the... Zen is a finger pointing at the moon. If you mistake the finger for the moon... The map is not the territory, but interestingly, from the standpoint, and that's the first law of whatever it is that he was studying.
General semantics.
Yeah, that's it. That's the first law of that. The map, but interestingly, from the standpoint of meditation, the map itself is territory. The map is not the territory, but it can be regarded as territory itself to study. We can study our maps. And the whole task, so I've got 1 minute. The whole task of this practice is to construct right view. Because from right view, all the other elements of the path follow, Buddha says. At least that's what we think. It's what we heard. Thus have I heard. So our task is to construct right view, right understanding, which means, you know, the Dalai Lama is talking about right understanding, right view, when he's talking about the need to understand emptiness in order to be free from the delusions of self and need and all the delusions that lead us to expect things that are not going to happen and suffer. So we do that with our meditation practice and by studying the teachings of the Buddha who pointed where we should direct our attention so that we notice and we can start to shape our understanding, our view, so that we can, right views, the knowledge, the understanding that enables us to live without making things worse. Without adding greed, hatred, and delusion to the experience. Do you want your experience with additives or without additives? Greed, hatred, and delusion. One more? Okay.
And at Eckhart, you would say that we are here to allow the universe to unfold around us.
I'm sorry?
Eckhart, you know.
Yeah, he would say...
We are here to allow the universe to unfold around us.
Well, you know, people want to give us purpose, But purpose is something we can make up. The notion that the universe is unfolding around us feels reifying the universe and us to me, because there's just this experience. It's all we've got. And we can interpret it as the universe, and we can make it into a oneness, and we can make ourselves part of it. Those are just conceptual games. To not suffer, we have to recognize the gestures in ourselves that lead us to make things worse, to hurt ourselves and others. And that's all the Buddha was concerned. He wasn't concerned with whether the cosmos was finite or infinite or one or many. People would come and ask him about that. I brought these suttas to read, but I didn't get to them. And he would just say, those are all thoughts. They're just thoughts. They are just map. And then we reify it. We believe our thoughts. And then we suffer. Unless the thoughts our understanding of the emptiness of our experience. So that's probably all I have to say. Thank you guys for your attention.
Thank you.